This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayed Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Rose Wellman about her new book, Feeding Iran, which was published just recently in 2021 by University of California Press. Rose is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. First of all, Rose, congratulations on your new book. It is an amazing work, and I really enjoyed reading it. And also, thanks for accepting my invitation, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
To start off, could you give us a bit of background about yourself and also your research?
Yeah, so I am an anthropologist, and I got my degree in anthropology, my PhD from the University of Virginia, where I had the tremendous fortune of having an amazing faculty, amazing advisors with great theoretical depth. So that was kind of my start. I also did major in anthropology back in undergraduate. I was one of those anthropology through and through. Then after I graduated my PhD, where I did work on Iran, but we'll be talking about that later, I was a postdoc at Princeton University at their Sharmeen and Bijan Mosava Rahmani Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies for 3 years. And then now I'm an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, where I am currently teaching students every day. So it's very exciting.
Thank you, Rose. And at the beginning of your book, in the acknowledgement part, I have noticed that you have mentioned that my late grandmother, Edith L.B. Turner, is the reason I became an anthropologist. Are we talking about the Edith Turner?
Yes. So I glossed over that earlier, but yes, I have an anthropological lineage or genealogy. My grandmother was Edith Turner, and my grandfather was Victor Turner. So I came to anthropology that way as well. Yeah.
Okay. How does it feel to have, you know, famous grandparents, Rose, especially with you being an anthropologist, when your grandparents were two of the most known anthropologists of all time?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, it sort of skipped a generation. My parents are both in poetry and literature and writing and things like this, but I got the great joy of living with my grandmother for 8 years when I was in graduate school. I lived with her in her house, and we're very close. We were very close. We share a birthday. It's definitely different. You grow up hearing about cultural relativity and about the importance of doing things with people and getting to know them. And it's never that kind of life as a kid where you're taught about, you know, to avoid other people or to stay away or to hate difference or things like that. You know, I was always raised to be culturally aware. So I think I had a very different approach than most people to anthropology because of my history.
Yeah. Thank you, Rose. And there is often a story behind every book. What's the story behind yours? I mean, why food? Why Iran?
Well, so I first became interested in Iran, not when I was in graduate school, but when I was an undergraduate student. And at the time, I had a roommate, basically like a floormate, who was Iranian. And she would invite me to her house, and I got to eat the amazing foods that her mother cooked and hear her speak Farsi, which is the language of Iran. And I kind of fell in love with the whole culture. It was also the year, my first year of undergrad was when 9/11 happened. And so I sort of became aware of the need to kind of dispel common stereotypes and myths about the Middle East and to combat those kinds of negative perceptions. So that was all part of it. But food, yeah, became in my mind from those early days of eating food with her and her family. And then later, when I went to Iran, and I was there three different occasions, and each time I could not ignore the food. It was a part of everything I did. Every invitation I went to, every circumstance I went to, there was food. There was a lot of it. People were offering it to me, and it was amazing. And so it just became something that I could not kind of do my work without attending to.
See, and I understand that part of your field work was in the capital, Tehran, and some other part in a small town in south of Iran, which you have chosen not to name. I mean, you call it Farsabad in mm-hmm. in the book, and you actually don't use the real name of the of that town to protect your participants' mm-hmm. identity. So why did you choose these two particular sites?
So as all students do when they're starting to do research in Iran, I ended up in Tehran initially. And that's where there's, you know, there's a language school that kind of supports foreign language people who are learning Persian. And there's also, it's just kind of the center of everything in Iran. So I started off in Tehran. And it was there that I met the very first trip, actually, was the first time I met the people who I would later do my research with. They just happened to be living across the hallway from an Iranian American friend I was staying with. And so we started to meet up. They had same age kind of young people. At that time, I was in my 20s, and they had same age young people, and we would go and do things together in Tehran. They lived in Ekbatan, which is a kind of suburb of Tehran. And so I just explored Iran with them from the very beginning. And eventually they led me through their family network to Farsabad, where which is near Shiraz, where I later spent most of my time doing research. And it was through their connections and their early, you know, invitation for me to come visit them and their family there during Nowruz and things like this, that I decided, okay, you know, this is where I could do research. And I knew that Tehran was a place where all the people who were doing research in Iran were focusing on. It was the site of the Green Movement protests. It was the site of most of my colleagues' research. And so I thought maybe if I go off the beaten path just a little bit to Farsabad, a 10-hour drive from Tehran, I could maybe learn more about kind of more provincial, I guess provincial has a lot of meanings, but people who literally who live in the provinces and don't necessarily are on the periphery of all the elites and so and those types of people in Tehran who kind of are the people in control. I wanted to see the kind of ordinary everyday people's lives that aren't in the urban centers.
I see, but they are not, I mean, all ordinary Iranian people. You yeah. focus on a very particular type of families that you call Basiji families. So yeah. could you tell us a bit more about, you know, Basiji families or Basiji people, or who are your interlocutors?
Yeah, so they are members of the Basij, and the Basij is a group of paramilitary people who kind of were formed by the late Ayatollah Khomeini in 1980 to defend Iran and the Islamic Republic at the time and during the Iran-Iraq War. They were the first to go to the front and be martyred, and they're distinct, subsidiary to and distinct from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. The way I became connected to this group, there were two reasons. One was this was the family, like I said, that happened to live across the hallway. So it was just happenstance. I happened to live across the hallway from an Iranian American friend in the suburb of Ekbatan. And so you know, I just started to meet these people. And so it was kind of just a mistake or a happy accident. Later, I purposely thought to myself, you know, this was the time of the Green Movement protests in Iran. And I did not want to endanger someone who was more of a reformist type position in the political landscape of Iran, which is a tremendously diverse political landscape. But so I thought to myself, like, maybe if I'm with a family that supports the state, I will not endanger them at all by doing my research. And so it was a very important thing for me to choose that direction. I also thought that that it would be interesting to understand and to kind of look at the lives of people who did support the Islamic Republic at a time when there was a lot of protests going on, you know, toward reform and change. So I thought it would be an interesting kind of problem to look at.
It is indeed interesting. And this kind of leads me to a follow-up question about your positionality. I mean, you were a white American woman, and especially with the, you know, type of mindset that you just described about your participants who are the supporters of the Islamic Republic. How did your positionality facilitate it or prevented your access to, you know, certain places or certain peoples?
So it's a very interesting question, and I'm glad you asked it because it certainly impacted my research quite a lot. Being white, being a British American person in particular, so I have two passports, I'm both British and American. Being British is what allowed me to get to Iran. But, you know, I had difficulties in various ways. One was difficulties getting a visa and things like that. And then later when I was in Farsabad where I lived, it was quite a rural community. And, you know, it was a farming community. It was a place where life was organized around a pickling factory and various orchards that people had in terms of gardening and things like this. And I, you know, being there, I was asked by my hosts who I lived with to, I was asked by them to not do research on my own. So I wasn't just going out to everyone and just talking to everyone in this town. Anytime I left the home, I had one of my host siblings with me or my host mother, Nusheen, with me. And they really kind of, you know, they facilitated my research, but it was also hard because I couldn't have that kind of I couldn't go wherever I wanted at any point. And this was actually further instilled in me when there was one time where I met the mayor of Farsabad and, you know, I told him I'm a researcher and I'm doing this. And he also clarified that, you know, as a white woman here in Farsabad, you should go out with an escort. And so my research was colored by that in a lot of different ways. On the one hand, because I was a woman, I could live with the family and I could participate in their lives and I could be inside the house and everyone could be comfortable. I mean, when I was in the house, I did wear hijab. I wore long sleeves and things like this. But I also was able to do that. I was able to be there. If I had been a man, that would not have been possible. But at the same time, I had some restrictions in my movements and my ability to do research. So it produced this for me. When I reflect on it, I think, you know, my ethnography is very intimate in the sense that I really got to know people, a small group of people and their relatives and their neighbors and their family kind of spread across several cities, but I got to know them very intimately. I did not, however, get to know like many, many people in the town and talk to, you know, hundreds of strangers. So it really colored my research, but it led to some good things and led to some restrictions at the same time.
See. And this is, again, kind of about your positionality, but we know that, you know, anthropology began as a colonial discipline, right? And it was, at its early days, at least, uniquely focused on, you know, culture, language, or biology of non-European peoples. Mm-hmm. And anthropologists often, you know, have positioned themselves as the so-called objective observers of the exotic other. Now we have at least to some degree, moved away from that kind of thinking and that kind of approach. But even some of today's anthropological works produced by white Western anthropologists position non-Western subjects and non-Western field sites, non-Western practices, non-Western languages and rituals as sources of data rather mm-hmm. than as partners in knowledge production, as true and valid legitimate owners of their own voices and of their own histories. Now, how did you, as a Western anthropologist who was working in a non-Western context and with non-Western interlocutors and their non-Western rituals and practices, kind of navigate these kinds of moral or ethical, if you will, issues?
Well, I tried to, I currently teach, like right now I'm teaching a class on Islamophobia, and a big part of that class I teach about Orientalism, and I teach about the structural kind of dynamic between East and West and the way that the West has created an East and in this power relationship that creates a lot of stereotypes as well. And I think, thinking back, I navigated it in a couple of different ways. And one was that I was very much in the mode of not only participant observation, but what we might call observant participation. And I was in the mode of reflexive anthropology, which means that I in the book, I think you can see this, that I bring myself into the text, but not so much that I become the focus of the text, but so much that you can see that how my views are somewhat shaping what I write and how what I write is shaping my views. And I think that comes out a bit. I think that's important because it's impossible to be completely objective. And, I very much am a strong believer in kind of Roy Wagner's theory of the invention of culture and how we're always kind of inventing something based on our own cultural predispositions. We have to recognize that. And so that's important. When it came to the idea of being a British American person in Iran at that time, the biggest way I saw it on an everyday basis was that people would ask me to write them a davatname or a letter to come to America. Now, I had no idea at the time where that power to do that would come from within me as this graduate student doing research in Iran. And I didn't have that capacity to write these letters of invitation. But I, it showed me the positionality that I had of being, from the West, from America, with these passports, in fact, two passports that by which I could go anywhere, pretty much. And these people just really wanted to be able to visit America and see America. And even these are Basij people who supported the state, and people might think they don't even want to know English or things like this, but no, they did. And they wanted to learn more about America's culture. And so there was a difference there that I could move and they had to stay. And that was something that was hard. And it remains hard. I'm still in touch with my hosts. And it remains hard that, when I talk to them now, years have passed, people have had children, lives have changed, but I'm able to move around the globe as a passport holder, of American passport holder, and they have much more trouble doing that. And so it's very clear, and it definitely shapes the research. And so I think that it's really important. It's become even more important that anthropologists are, with new issues that have come up lately in the field of anthropology, that we are honest about our positionality as researchers and like things like this. So I say in the book, my religious orientation I talk about in the book, because I think that's important too, how people in Iran often saw me as someone to convert. So it wasn't always the power relationship you might expect. You might expect that because I'm Westerner, I have the kind of the power. But when I was there alone. I didn't travel with anyone else, and I was a woman. And so there was a power relationship also going the other way too, to be honest, where people mm-hmm. saw me as someone that they could teach or become a mentor to me. And so often I was being put in a position of, I hope you will convert to Islam. I hope I will be the one to convert you, because then I will go to heaven. And so I got that a couple of times. And, you know, I really threw myself in. You know, I did prayer with Nusheen every day when she invited me to do it with her. I learned namaz. I learned the daily prayer. I went to the mosque with them. I did the prayer. I didn't just sit on the outside and observe. And I learned a lot through that, through embodying those motions and saying those words. And in the book, I try to talk about how I struggled, the tension I have with, you know, I was raised, as you mentioned, by anthropologists who threw themselves in, I would say, to ritual and to, yes. And to all of that. And so when, with that perspective, I threw myself into it, but at the same time, I'm not my grandparents. I'm not quite the same way. I was raised a little bit with a little more cynicism and skeptic nature, I guess. So I always kind of kept that what we might call methodological agnosticism, not quite theism, which is where you like fully believe everything the people you're doing to. I kind of always kept a little distance, but that's just who I am. I don't know. It's hard when you're an anthropologist, everything you are affects your research. And I really believe that. And you have to be aware of that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thank you, Rose.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So, moving on to the contents of your book, your book has 4 ethnographic chapters, and 2 of these chapters have a heavy focus on food, whereas the other 2 don't. But what is common in all these chapters is, as far as I understood, an exploration of kin-making processes in post-revolutionary Iran among supporters of the Islamic Republic or Basiji mm-hmm. families. And you talk about how kinship is perceived by Basiji families as both a threat and a resource. Mm-hmm. And you frame this through what you call physio-sacred qualities of kinship. Mm-hmm. So what are these physio-sacred qualities? I mean, what do you mean by that? And how does it manifest?
Okay. So let me just take a step back and kind of tell you a little bit about how I approach kinship, because I think that will help. So in anthropology for a long time, right, people saw kinship through a genealogical frame. And this was in people like Pitt Rivers and even the structural anthropologists and so on. They tended to think of kinship as a genealogical frame. Genealogy or blood and marriage being 2 key ways that people do kinship. But not many people who had done research in the Middle East have thought of kinship in that way. beyond that way. So there was a move in kinship studies that sought to think about kinship in a different way. And it's often called relatedness, or it's called new kinship studies. And it's a way of thinking about how people construct family ties by doing things, or maybe by in through processes of things or rituals, or maybe by living together or by eating together, or through living in a house, or through various things that people can do that can also shape networks of kin. And so one of the things that I noticed in my research in Iran was that other things were shaping kinship in much the same way. So it wasn't just blood, and it wasn't just law, or even Islamic law, although that was important. It was also the way in which people understood kinship to be shaped through food and through shared qualities of purity and shared qualities of trust and shared qualities of, you know, kind of embodying certain religious ethics in their daily lives. And these, I call these kind of acts of kinship. And so I look at how people form kinship through doing things like praying together, eating food together, and not just food, but food that has been blessed or made pure or somehow changed through ritual, through prayer, and then how that shapes the bodies of kin. So when I'm talking about kinship as a physio-sacred thing, it's also part of not putting the Cartesian dualist model of body and self, of spirit and matter, onto my interlocutors in Iran, who didn't really have quite that same distinction. They saw their body and their spirituality or their spirit as being very much intertwined. And so, you know, if you ate some food that was not halal, it would make a mark on your face, or it would shape your temperament, or it would shape your body in some way. So your spiritual and your embodied selves were connected. And this was the same for kin. So kin, I realized this during my research, that kin could kind of, they could develop together. So more through eating the right food that came from the right places, that had the right prayers, they could develop embodied physio-sacred stuff of kinship. Could be altered in a good way, or it could be harmed through embodying or eating the wrong types of food that maybe had were contaminated by some ill wish, ill-intended prayer, or by other, maybe by not being halal or things like this. And so all of these things together could shape your family and your ability to be a good person and relate to other people in your family in the right way.
So would it be safe to say that, you know, what you discussed with regard to commemorating and burial of martyrs, or should I say reburial of martyrs who were killed in the 8-year-long Iran-Iraq war, is an extension of these kinship-making processes that you're talking about?
Well, yes, because so just quickly going back to the family, if this cooking and feeding was shaping and protecting families at home, then I saw a very an analogical thing happening with the nation, because at the level of the nation, you could see that there was this physio-sacred shaping of people who came out to participate in the rituals of state power. So they were also kind of working with the same physio-sacred stuff of kinship that was always shifting and object of prayer, but they were putting that on to brothers and sisters of Islam who are citizens of the nation state. So when you're talking about this commemoration for martyrs, this is one of the key things that happened in my fieldwork and kind of shaped my research. So when I was in Farsabad, at one point, they had brought two unknown martyrs from the border of Iran and Iraq, and the martyrs were brought to be reburied in the town park. And they were brought by a Peristatal Martyrs Foundation, and that foundation was funded by the state. And during the ceremony surrounding this reburial of these two unknown martyrs, the local religious leader, who they call a Friday Imam, addressed the crowd. And I remember that he called on the participants to think of themselves as kin of the martyrs. And this is a common theme in Iranian nationalism in general, this idea of brother and sisterhood and so on, an Islamic brother and his sisterhood. But he said, because this martyr is unknown, we the people are his brother, his sister, his mother. And then after that prayer, uniformed soldiers distributed cups of yogurt, juice boxes, and plates, including lentils and rice, which is adas polo, which is a favorite of mine. So everyone loves it. So the food that each participant ate was paid by the Foundation for Preservation of the Heritage and Distribution of Sacred Defense. So that's that peristatal unit. And so it struck me that there's this resonance between what's happening in the family at home with the cooking and feeding practices that are so religiously oriented and are meant to shape the family in the right way, and these Islamically oriented state rituals that legitimize a certain view of citizenship. And this view of citizenship is not shared by everyone, but it is shared by these Basij, who I did my research with at least, and it was shared by them because they really saw these connections and thought they were important, that somehow the household, their household and the nation state were connected through these analogies, that they actually were explicitly connected in this way. And so there was really kind of like a biopolitical shaping of citizens through food in these ritual events. Now, at the same time, Iran has other ways of shaping people through food as a state. And so they have, you know, halal borders where in most cases, the borders are regulated in terms of can halal products or not halal, products that are not halal be brought over, and the answer is no. And so there's that level of state kind of control of what people eat. And then there's also like different restaurants and things like that and how these things structure the bodies of citizens who go to eat at, say, a cafe, or if they go to a specific kind of, I don't know, restaurant that is organized for Basiji families, and it has a very different way of being laid out and things like this. So you can go to a Western style cafe in Iran, or you can go to other settings where family units kind of are encouraged to go. So all of these things are being debated right now in Iran, and there's a lot of kind of issues around where people go, how they eat, how they dress when they eat, what kinds of foods are being served. Is it foreign? Is it local? Is it halal? Obviously, most of the food that is served is halal, but all of these threads are operating right now in Iran and are shaping citizens, and they're kind of navigating what they want to be through the foods that they eat.
And this focus on food, Rose, was it something you had in mind before entering the field work? Did you have an interest in food? Did you look for, you know, food practices that could, you know, examine these kinship processes or these, you know, nation making processes? Or did it like present itself to you? Did it emerge as a theme while you were doing your field work as a means through which, you know, these particular systems of kinship could be examined?
You know, it kind of, I came to it through, so I told you this earlier, I went to Iran three times, two times for preliminary research and the third time for a long, much longer, you know, real field work during my graduate years. And it took me until the second or third time to realize the significance of food. So I've always loved Iranian food, like I've loved to eat it, but you know, I went to Iran with the idea of studying kinship. I had no concept of thinking about food, but I had read some anthropological essays on the role of food in constructing kinship in different places. So I was really well read on kinship literature. And so when I went to Iran and I saw how food was, you know, when people sat together around what Iranians call the sofre, which is kind of, it could be anything, but it's like a cloth on the ground where people put their food and they display it in a, usually it's a very beautiful symmetrical display and people sit in kind of an organized way around it. I started to see the significance of food for the family unit. And I think the moment it hit me the most was the first time I went to the Iranian New Year celebrations in Farsabad. And I saw that everyone, we went to this grassy bank on the side of a river. And everyone, every family unit had their own sofre. They had their own cloth and they were gathered around it and they brought their own food. And the only thing they were sharing between the different sofres that they had on the ground was tea. That was the only thing. And then later in the night, extended families shared kebab. But the meals, the lunch meals, the main foods were shared with each family unit. And then I started to see that there was a lot of work being done to think about who one can visit. And most of the meals people ate with their own family. They didn't go to, a cousin's house or a neighbor's house for lunch meals in particular. There were other times when one could visit, but during those meals, it was very important to kind of stick with your family unit for the most part. And going to grab a sandwich, from a shop was frowned upon. It was important to eat that home-cooked food from your mother, from your, that had been kind of vetted by the whole family and had been brought to the house where you knew the baker, you knew the person who had sold and bought you the rice and things like this. And so it was, I saw how the food was very important because of that physiosacred quality of the family. What you ate was so important for ensuring the health and welfare of your family. And this was in a society that my interlocutor said was failing in a lot of ways. You know, even though they supported the revolution and they supported the current Ayatollah of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader in particular, they supported him, but they saw that there was a lot of problems in Iran society. They had an incursion of another substance, drugs, from Afghanistan that they said was the effect of American foreign policy in Afghanistan. And their drugs were abundant in their community, particularly heroin and also opium. And not only that, but there were problems that they saw, like divorce or premarital dating and things like this that they saw as wrong. And so they had to, they felt like they had to do something to protect, to change things. And so this was this heavy emphasis on food in shaping their families and in arranging. And so I couldn't ignore it when that happened. And I started to see that this would actually help me think about kinship in a different way too. Because if kinship isn't just blood and it isn't just law and it's all these processes that people do to shape their families, then it's something more. And this is a context where kinship usually in the Middle East has been portrayed as, patrilineal or something like this. And I thought kinship is more than this. And so I wanted to show that.
And with this heavy focus on food and heavy emphasis on food in your book, I imagine that you must have some, food-related memory during your field work that has stayed with you that you could share with us. And I'm asking this because this is a podcast on new books in food studies. Do you have any such memory?
I have a couple. I was thinking about, on one occasion, I went to this shrine. It was a descendant of, I think it was the Imam Musa Kazam. And we were at this shrine and this woman was standing outside of the shrine. There's almost no one there because this is like a far off descendant, maybe a grandson or granddaughter of, it's an Imamzadeh, it's a descendant of an Imam. And I'm at the shrine and this woman is handing us ash. And ash is a very common vote of soup. It's made with wheat noodles and all kinds of vegetables. It says it's like green texture and then it's a green color and then it's kind of thick. And it's got this wheat noodle consistent. Wheat noodles are one of the main ingredients and also beans sometimes. And also it's decorated on the top with kashka kind of yogurt type thing. And also with fried onions. And it's a very interesting food. It's not something that you would think of as being the most delicious food, but you kind of grow to love it. And people, I think, have very strong feelings associated with it because it's a very commonly used votive food, as I said. And so I just remember eating this votive soup that this woman gave us and how my host mother, and it was good because at that point I'd gotten used to eating ash. It took me a little while to get used to it, but I was eating it and she told me that, I was so lucky to eat this votive fare. And because it was so, the woman who had made it was so sincere in her vow. And so, and she was there alone. And for some reason, we felt like it was so important that we'd eaten this food. And so that's what struck me and what I remember from a food memory. The other funnier one was when I tried to cook lasagna for my host family, because I thought maybe I'll contribute something. And they did not like my food at all. They said it was strong, but I could tell by the looks on their faces that they were kind of thinking, what is this that you made for us? This is not real food. So anyway.
Hey. I wish I hadn't asked that question, Rose, because now I'm longing for Ash. Yeah. I haven't eaten it for the past 6 years, I guess.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot more in the book, and I encourage listeners to pick up a copy. But before we wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, Rose, or are you thinking about doing a research on a particular topic in the near future?
I'm actually, because I'm currently located in Dearborn, Michigan in the United States, I am in this amazing, I don't know if you've heard of this, but I'm in this amazing community that is the heart of Arab Detroit. And mm-hmm. a lot of the people here are first or second generation immigrants to the US. And a lot of them speak Arabic, and it's a very unique place. I highly recommend anyone to visit it. We also have a large Lebanese, a large Iraqi, and a large Yemeni community, a large Syrian community as well. And so I'm here, and I did my research in Iran, and a lot of it had to do with food, and a lot of it had to do with religion, Islam. And so I'm looking at working with Iraqis, Shia Iraqis here, who do some of the similar practices to Iranians, but they do them in their, it's not, there's some big mosques here, but a lot of the practices happen in people's basements. They've converted their little bungalow houses to ritual centers. And you'd be surprised, like garages and basements, and the innovation of this community is amazing. And they've also established many successful businesses and things, and like totally changed the community and actually rejuvenated it a lot after the 2008 economic recession. So anyway, I'm going to do my research here with this community. And part of what I will be doing is looking at foodways and looking at, I'm also interested in perhaps looking at blood donation activities here around Muharram, because that's also related to my research. So I'm a couple different directions, but I'm in a good place to do some really fascinating work, more work on food, actually. So I'm excited about that.
That sounds like a very interesting project and very important too. Yeah. I can't wait to read it whenever it comes out. Thank you so much, Rose, for coming on the show and speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your work with our listeners. I really enjoyed reading your book, but I enjoyed it even more talking to you about it. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.